This is the Change Management Podcast by the University of South Wales. I'm Dr. Louise Bright, and today I'm joined by Dr. Arthur Turner from the Professional Development Centre. So far in this series of podcasts, we've focused on the challenges associated with dealing with change. In this episode, we'll be discussing some of the positive things that change can bring. But before we start, Arthur, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, I've had a very interesting career, and I started off as a botanist. I was a nurse and I worked as a manager in the health service. But for the last 25 years or so, I've been moving steadily towards a more academic kind of teaching career, I suppose, which has taken in working with all sorts of small and large organisations across Wales and more recently in Europe, actually. I've mainly concentrated in the last 5 years or so on studying leadership and executive coaching, not exclusively. And in that journey, I've covered quite a bit of interesting material around creativity.
And possibly we'll come to your puppets later on.
Oh, the famous puppets.
The famous puppets. I think you win hands down the most diverse career that we've had from any guest on the podcast so far. So saying that, thinking about the positives about change, do you think in your experience it's easier to adapt and make changes when there's a real sense of urgency that a crisis brings, so maybe like the pandemic that we're experiencing now?
I think inevitably the answer is yes. I think organisations are people after all and respond in that way where they kind of galvanise to a purpose, I suppose. But there's also something in my mind around the work of Keith Grint, who describes different types of approaches to change. And I suppose change where you're pressured into it is more like an emergency or more like, you know, a fire or a major catastrophe where there has to be some urgent action. Whereas I suspect what we're experiencing now, although needs some urgent action in some places, is also about a bit more about contemplative thinking around what's going on so you make the right decisions. And I suspect that there has to be a balance. So it's not all urgent action. There's also some reflection and some pondering on what's going on before making decisions that you can't undo.
Interested in learning about driving organizational change? Search for the USW Changemaker program.
So I guess really in the context of coronavirus, we all had that sense of urgency right at the start where we were all in crisis mode.
Yes.
And I guess we're forced, like you say, we had to change, we had to adapt to survive. And do you think we're moving now into that more reflective phase? You know, there is more a sense of a new normality emerging.
I think people are getting used to, or some people are getting used to, I myself have been in my house, apart from a walk every day or a bit of exercise every day, for about 4 months, which is very, very unusual. And I suppose I've come to accept the rhythm of my existence, I guess, even though outside there's other more urgent things going on. And maybe that's what part of the challenge, isn't it? That we, as human beings, quickly adapt to our situation and accept it as normal. Now, whether that's a good place to be, absolutely, I'm not sure. Because I think you can become complacent and waiting for something else to happen rather than trying to plan a kind of more innovative, creative way of running along with change, sort of sitting as change as a partner rather than something that's done unto you.
And you mentioned there complacency. How do you keep your teams, your organisation moving forward and avoid complacency, do you think?
I think there's been some evidence from the way in which teams in large organisations, and I'm thinking of particularly the NHS, but also sort of teams of people who are able to, say, create a major hospital in 14 days or something, where they seem to have a sort of momentum. And I think part of that is around the way in which the leaders of those teams or the leaders within those teams are probably more collaborative. So we've seen lots of collaboration around, say, Dyson helping with equipment for intensive care, for example, whereby collaboration and maybe asking questions. So I was particularly impressed by the leader of the team that was looking at vaccinations, pulling together a worldwide team of experts by saying, well, you know, we sit together on a virtual platform and we listen carefully to what people say and we ask questions. Now, this is exactly what Keith Grint says we should be doing in terms of the sorts of problems that he predicted mankind would face in the future, which are things we've never seen before, things we don't know what to do. And that doesn't take sort of authority and urgency. It takes calm contemplation of the facts. And when I looked at the BBC taking their cameras into intensive care units, both in Britain and around the world, one of the things that struck me was that the commentators commented on how calm it was, how purposeful it was, rather than what you might imagine. I don't know, headless chickens is an expression that comes to mind, but where you might expect people to be rushing around trying to do lots of things. But there was this calmness which comes from, I think, practice, teamwork, asking questions, a lack of hierarchy, and people pulling in the same direction.
That lack of hierarchy is interesting, isn't it? You mentioned the NHS as an example of a large organisation that is effectively managing change. Do you think it's easier for smaller organisations to really grasp the positives that change can bring?
That's a really difficult question to answer, because I'm sure there are examples of big organisations that are bad at it and parts of big organisations that are good at it, but also smaller organisations sometimes, I guess, don't have the resources to make it easy for them to master change. I was struck by people telling me that, you know, pub owners, you know, the next day had sorted out how to prepare meals for the community near us in a nice spot of the Ridgeway, where there's a lovely view. There's a small cafe, and it took them a couple of weeks, but they had gone from a sit-down cafe with lunches to ones that would serve strawberries and cream and coffee from windows that they'd recreated out of their windows. You know, they'd refashioned their little cafe to respond to a need. And that seemed to be to do with enthusiastic, encouraging individuals who are leading that kind of response.
So thinking about small organisations and large organisations, you've talked about communication, you've mentioned collaboration, enthusiasm. What do you think are the key things that we can learn from those who've been successful at coping with the pandemic and really thriving in a changing time?
Well, one thing that struck me was the idea that this could be something that was fashioned around the theory of coaching, without being kind of too fanciful about it, I suppose. I mean, I walk through in my head the principle of coaching, so. And you'll be familiar with this, Louise, the kind of the building rapport, finding out what the purpose of the coaching is, listening, using silence, fine-tuning questions so that the questions are helpful. And on top of that is ways in which people have found creative ways of developing new services, new ways of responding to change. And I suppose there were two things that struck me recently. I was reading a Dr. Seuss book with my grandson called Oh, the Places You Will Go. And I don't know whether you know it, but it's a lovely little book. But you get to the middle of the book where the character gets stuck in what he calls the waiting place, and talking about waiting for your hair to grow, waiting for the kettle to boil, waiting for the phone to ring. And I suppose we're kind of familiar with that kind of stasis that happens in some parts of our lives at some time. But one thing that I thought of also, individuals were taking action. So it's very coaching-like approach. You know, you ask questions, you listen, you get on with the person who's supporting you, then you decide to take action. And I suppose go back to where we started. It was, you know, what you mentioned, or what I think I mentioned, is around reflecting on what's happening, you know, and particularly reflecting on your reflections. So being a really deep thinker around these things, I think, helps with a sprinkling of creativity, helps people to understand what to do next.
Talking about creativity, and this is where I want to bring your puppets in, can you talk to us about, you know, the development sessions that you do with a vast range of different people from different organisations? And I think whenever I talk to people about you, somewhere in the conversation, there will be mention of your puppets. How do you use those?
Well, you have to, I suppose a little bit of history might help if we've got time. My son brought home a Che Guevara finger puppet a long time ago, 5 or 6 years ago. It was given to him at work for a Christmas present. It had a magnet which stuck on the fridge, and I kept looking at this character. And I found a company that produced hundreds of characters, both dead and alive and fictional, including things like Munchie's The Scream and the delightful Pavlov's Dog, but a collection of multiracial characters, multi-ethnic, multicultural. And I was really attracted to those. So I kind of started using them, but it seemed that people really liked them. So it fitted in with the idea of when you're learning about something, to touch something, to be actively engaged with a bit of learning, you can use them in terms of helping you think. So they act as a critical friend. They act as a stimulus. They are very funny as well. And perhaps going back to the sort of the way in which organizations can master change is knowing that human beings actually like to play a bit. You know, we are characterized by being a play species, I suppose. And that if you can induce a little bit of play, even in the darkest hour, I think that really helps people feel that they're together in a team, moving forward in a collegiate way, rather than perhaps responding to instructions or a piece of paper that tells you what to do.
That's a really good point, I think. And that's been really well played out in the current circumstance where I think teams have come together really quickly to do quite innovative stuff online, as you say, to keep them together as a team. So, you know, there's kind of been online scavenger hunts, quizzes, all sorts of things where you think actually, you know, that we're all going through such a difficult period, but actually we've all realised, consciously or unconsciously, that we need to keep that connection in a much more lighthearted way than just a work way.
Yes, indeed. And it does, not all things go back to coaching, but it's that idea of when I'm facilitating the learning of coaching, it's often the thing I start with and start every day with or every session with is you need to build rapport. And in rapport building is the essence of humanness, you know, funniness, funny stories, warmth, and all those things seem to be emanating from these random groups that have been set up that have just spontaneously come together. I went back to an old story. There was a knee surgeon in Wales called John Fairclough, very famous man, very eminently proficient at mending people's knees. And he was worried that his operation to repair the middle of the knee, the cruciate ligament, was not actually very good. You know, it didn't repair very well. And he was watching his daughter plait her hair. And he thought, oh, that's a really good idea. And he asked her, you know, why she was plaiting it. And she said, well, it stops the split ends and it makes it, I can control it a bit better. And it's like really strong, you know. And if you do, this was a 3-braided plait, I think. And then he went to his local hairdresser and got the hairdresser to teach him how to do a 4-braided plait. And he created a new operation that has secured lots of professional footballers and rugby players' knee joints. And it's sort of the way in which that kind of you take inspiration from unexpected places, I suppose, which gives you drive and energy and interest. Curiosity, perhaps, is another word, rather than expecting that you know what to do in a change situation by reading a manual or asking an expert. You know, within all of us is this ability to find creative ways to solve problems.
That's a really good story. I remember that one.
Yeah, the Welsh plait. It's called the Welsh plait in the literature around repairing people's cruciate ligaments.
But it does kind of go back, it does tie back to that comment you made about having fun and giving people permission to not do something totally serious and see what happens.
Yes, there's a lightness about it. And of course, he said, well, I've tried it out, it seems to work. I'm not going to report on it for 3 years. I'm going to make sure that this is the way I need to do this, to refine it. And the notion of an eminent orthopedic surgeon sitting with a hairdresser to teach him, it's a very humbling kind of process, I think. And therefore, I've noticed that lots of people are accessing support around change from the unexpected sources. You know, we're respecting much more at the moment those people who do somewhat, you know, perhaps menial jobs, but still have skills and ideas, particularly ideas, that can help us all.
Final question, Arthur. What do you think managers and leaders can do to kind of keep that sense of urgency, but more importantly, that positivity towards change?
I think the personal attributes of perhaps managers, a number of things, I suppose, they need to be positive in themselves, you know, seeing the possibilities, not being unrealistic, but being emanating, oozing positivity, I guess. I think they need to be open and this very, you know, openness and honest about what's going on. That lots of problems seem to have been arising from people not telling the truth or trying to hide the truth. I guess they need to be engaging. I think they need to respect everybody in the team, whatever their grade, whatever they're paid, whatever their seniority is. And this respect actually helps to galvanize teams. So this mutual respect, a kind of trustfulness, if that's a word. And that to know that, to solve some of these issues around how do you cope with change that's being forced upon you, is to remember that human beings are creative, you know, that they understand the world through an emergence of ideas rather than the idea being presented whole, and that we access the world through things like colour, language, singing, poetry, finger puppets, you know, there's all sorts of ways in which you can access ideas. And these, what I think in coaching would be called pivotal moments, come to teams when they're working in this way. But that's clearly opposite to perhaps a more traditional view of a manager who might be telling people what to do in a crisis. Now, that Keith Grint, to go back to Keith Grint, says, is what happens when there's an emergency and a perfectly reasonable response. But it's not where we are today. It's not where we need to be. And where we need to be is much more collaborative. Collaboration needs softer human skills.
Arthur, thank you for your time today and sharing your reflections with us on change.
A real pleasure. Joachim Ariel.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. If you want to hear more of the Change Management podcast, please don't forget to subscribe. And to find out more about this podcast and how the University of South Wales can help your business, visit southwales.ac.uk/business.